out of a halfway house, because that's where the girl went, co-ed halfway house. And then there was that time in the 70s when we showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous drunk and high, and I remember throwing stuff at people and laughing, you know. So I don't know, you know, that wasn't my, those two times were not my sobriety date, nor were they my idea. And I think it's important, if you're going to be here, that this is pretty much your idea. For many of us, it's our last stop. It's the last house on the block. It's a haven for those of us that want to get, and you, can you see that this is a fourth edition big book? Now, either I've used this a lot, which I do, but this book is only 2 years old, or they make really crappy big books nowadays, you know. But let me read two things out of it. And the first part is, we have Alcoholics Anonymous for more than 100 men and women. They lied. There wasn't. There was only 86 of them, to be accurate. Dick B. says there was 87. But the people I followed said there was 86. So we're not going to quibble over one. But out of those 86 people, or 87 that Dick says, 80 of them stayed sober, never having drank again, which means they tapped into permanent sobriety when they became serious, you know. But it says, who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered, and they italicize that, this Quigley writing. My sponsor said anytime they use italics in the book, he said to me, David, pay attention. They're trying to get your attention. That is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. Meaning, I can take my experiences of what it's like for me when I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous's doorstep as an alcoholic, drug addict, crackhead, methamphetamine junkie, pill popper, whatever my alcoholism is manifesting themselves in. And I can use these pages, the first 44 pages, to identify whether I'm alcoholic or not, which means whether I'm powerless or not, you know, whether I have that physical allergy coupled with the mental obsession, you know. And if that be the case and I'm out of answers, then maybe I might want to do what the people that wrote this book did that had successful, continuous, you know, joyful recovery, no matter what was going on. And that wasn't my experience, as you can tell. This is my fourth time in Alcoholics Anonymous that I can count. And the last part I can read that I never did, by the way, because, I had a book. I'm not sure when I got it. I think it was my first journey in AA from 92 to 95. I still have the book. It's kept out in the shed. It's missing the first 80-plus pages. The dog used it as a chew toy, and it's a reminder to me that the dog had better sobriety than I did. But I like the stories in the back, but I didn't have a clue that the program is not this, which I thought it was. The program is what's outlined in the book. And this last part that I never did until this time, I was a sponsor in name my second time in AA. And I think the guy had me, or one or two guys had me as a sponsor in name so they could keep people off their ass if they asked them, do you have a sponsor? You know, kind of important if you say the guy's name that he knows you're a sponsor, you know, but I didn't, you know. So it says this, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking, and immunity means protection from drinking, as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message. They're talking about carrying this message, not my freaking rehab message, not my multiple hundreds of grand worth of therapeutic message, none of that bull, not the crap that I hear in 90% of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm telling you, I walk in meeting Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have a clue where I am anymore. I don't. I'm sitting in a meeting 2 weeks ago, and they were talking, working on their defects of character. And I'm like, the book doesn't mention any of that stuff. I don't have a clue when you're talking. By the way, if you use that, I'm not here to offend you. But I don't have a freaking clue what you're talking about, because defects of character or spiritual maladies, I can't remove my own defects. It's like praying. I'm praying for patience, right? I'm going to work on patience, right? And then I get some asshole in front of me that won't go fast enough. You know what I'm saying? It's like, get out of my way! So I don't work on my defects of character. I don't have the ability to remove them. God does. Ask him. That's the work. All you have to do is look for them. Watch is what the big book says, right? But I digress, okay? So that's my little, I'll get off the soapbox and share in a gentle way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. So I remember my very first drink of alcohol. I think I was 5, discovered porn at the same time, and not a good combination. Those things would plague me for years, you know. But I remember my friend, who is one of us, I'm not sure if he's alive or dead, but he became one of us back in the 70s, and we're the same age, and he was my best friend. But anyway, I remember Michael opened up the fridge, and it was a true alcoholic dream of a fridge. No food, a stick of butter, and loaded with beer, you know. And so Mike pulls out this thing, and like he I'm going to date myself. They're the kind of cans that you pull the top off. You with me? And I remember him taking a swig, or he handed it to me first. Not really important, but I remember I had this abnormal reaction. It wasn't soda. It didn't taste like ice cream. But because at 5 years old, I cared what Michael thought of me, I took a big old gulp. Now, I'm here to tell you, if I could have drank enough of that, I probably would have tried to drink everything that was in the fridge so I passed out. Because once I got to that certain point when I realized what alcohol could do for me, I pursued it to the gates of insanity and death. The closer to death, the better. I didn't care. You know, we're the type of people that you ever get with those guys where they buy a bottle, take the lid off and throw it out. Guess what? That sucker don't get closed. Now, the bottle may end up, but you make sure you drink all of it, you know. If not, it's alcohol abuse. But I digress. At 5 years old, I did not hang out with the rest of the kindergartners, you know, hitting the 40 and stuff. That wasn't my experience. I didn't drink again till sometime in high school. And once I discovered what alcohol could do for me, I remember back in high school, I had aspirations to go to MIT. And back in the 60s, MIT was the top university for engineering and mathematics, probably in the world, at least in the United States. And I remember I wanted to go. But they had that requirement. You got to be good at school. And you know what? It's kind of hard to have those aspirations and not have the ability to follow it up because you're freaking lazy. But I was lazy. But anyway, I remember I wanted to go. And I remember going past the guys in my neighborhood who had a clubhouse behind their house. And they were doing the bad stuff, you know. And I remember specifically saying to myself, you know, you'll never be like them. And I didn't call them losers, but that's what I would have used if I knew that term. I didn't know that term. But I remember specifically saying as I'm walking past, I'll never be like them. Within 2 years, not only was I like them, they were kicking me out because they didn't like how I like bogarted and date myself, all the stuff, you know. And so, needless to say, my high school aspirations didn't pan out too well. Something to the effect that I was, they liked me as an individual, but they didn't like me showing up drunk and high in school and making my own classes. And I got escorted out. And in the 70s, I ended up in this educational program that Jimmy Carter made out called 70,001, and I excelled at it. I had probably been sober at the time, and I made this model for the program, and I made it. Nobody asked me to do it, but they liked it so much they wanted to recognize me at a national level. And so, at 15 years old, they took me up to the to this banquet that they were giving these awards to everybody, and they were going to recognize me on the stage. And it was this little beehive that was about this big, and it showed the little bees with no, you know, a little bee going in the bottom of the beehive and coming out the top with their diploma and stuff and a little thing and one of their little paws or whatever an insect paw is called. And so anyway, you know, I noticed that there was this girl there, and I wanted what she had, and I was willing to go to any length to get it. And I'm not sure who she was with, but I remember walking into her hotel room in the Sheridan Suites Hotel, and there was a guy there who was trying out for the Flyers, and he was from one of their farms team. And they asked me this question that you don't ask somebody who has a big ego but really low self-esteem. They asked me, "Have you ever done this?" And what they were doing was injecting methamphetamine. And of course, with a low self-esteem, I couldn't say no. And the next thing I know, I become a methamphetamine junkie. Now, I know, woe to all you pure-blood alcoholics. Sorry to offend you, but there's drugs in my story. You know. And thank God for that, because that really did the trick for me this time while I got here. But I'm still a real alcoholic, okay? So anyway, I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And I remember coming home to Newark, Delaware, and I'm hanging out with guys from GM and Chrysler because they don't sell that stuff at high school. And I'm trying to get everybody I know to shoot up methamphetamine, and they all look at me like I'm growing another head out of my neck, you know. And so I just did what we do, you know, and I became very self-employed. My sponsor says that I had to learn new language. When I call self-employed, I mean I was a thief. Case in point, my sponsor one time asked me, he goes, Dave, I've heard you a lot say that you used to borrow your parents' vehicle, and we know you like dealing in fiction. That's not real, and we like dealing in fact. So let's get some background information. How old were you when you, quote-unquote, borrowed your parents' vehicle? And I was like, well, Keith, I was 14. He goes, so let's assume you didn't have a driver's license and you're not driving on a farm. He goes, so let me get down to brass tacks. Did you ask your parents permission that you could use their vehicle? And I looked at him like he was growing another head out of his neck. And I said, no. He goes, Dave, everywhere in the world they call it stealing. You call it borrowing. You got to learn to start to communicate like everybody else is. So anyway, being self-employed, a thief, and not very good at it, my future was pretty bleak. And they locked me up into a mental institution, and I escaped. Because in there they don't have the fun drugs. They got Halidol and Thorazine. And you know what? And doing the Thorazine shuffle is not my idea about getting higher fun, because it's not fun. You know, I don't care if you even smoke that stuff. It's not fun. You know? And what's bad is you end up, when they tie you down, they shoot you up, you end up peeing on yourself and stuff. And I had my little mental institution girlfriend, so I escaped. 3 days later, they caught me. They brought me back. It wasn't hard to do. I kept stealing food from the same restaurant every night, you know. And I come back, and now my mental institution girlfriend won't talk to me because I didn't take her with me. And just, you know. And my best friend at the time, who gave me my first hand-done tattoo, it was supposed to be a skull and crossbone. It looked like Mr. Bill when he was done, not very manly. But Gary was doing the best he can with the materials he had and stuff. And he goes, you don't want to be here, do you? And I was like, no. He goes, well, you want to know how you get out of here? And I was like, how? He goes, go to a drug rehab. Well, how do you do that? Tell them you're a heroin addict. Well, what's that? Don't worry, just tell it to them. And so I instantly became a heroin addict, you know. And, you know, a couple weeks later, I'm in a drug rehab. And 3 days later, just like Gary said, you can walk off. They won't even chase you. And sure enough, they didn't. You know, and 1979 came along, and my father died, and I hated my father. You know, he did the best he could with what he had, but I just hated him. And, you know, we get judgments, you know, created by our ego, living in fear, you know, with untreated whatever. And when he died, it was like somebody hit me and took the wind out of me. And that night, my best friend at the time was a Vietnam vet, and who regaled me with stories of Vietnam. He was a pathfinder, very dangerous job. They drop you off by either helicopter or you parachute off into an area, and then you try to get people to shoot at you to call in hunter-killer teams with loaches and all that stuff. Well, anyway, Charlie, I called him up. I'm devastated, and he knew right what to get. So he went to the liquor store, picked me up, and got this big bottle of vodka. Now, by that time, I'd already had vodka. Not a big fan, sorry to any vodka drinkers. Doesn't taste that good. And I'd already drank grapefruit juice. But apparently, when you mix those two together, they're palatable, you know. And vodka and grapefruit juice did something to me that caught my attention on a molecular level. It took away my father's death. It took away the sting of death. And made it okay, you know. And I'm not sure if I came too blacked out, whatever, doesn't matter. But the next recollection I have is I joined the military. I was in the infantry for 3 years, stationed in Hawaii. I remember when they offered me Hawaii. I was supposed to go to Alaska and be an airborne, and they came back. When I came back from my physical, they said, that job's been filled, but how'd you like to live in Hawaii? And I said to the guy, book 'em, Dano, you know, and off. And the only thing I know about Hawaii was Hawaii 5-0 and the Brady Bunch, you know. And, man, I know they got really killer marijuana, so I'm off, right? And so I go, and In my stay in the military was cool. I learned to do things that my mind said my body couldn't. I could run at my peak. I was running 2 miles in under 13 minutes. I was doing push-ups. I could do almost 60 in 2 minutes. I could do more sit-ups than I knew what to do and pass the PT test. In the infantry, we walked everywhere. We were lucky if we got transported anywhere. Most of the time, we walked everywhere, and it was 15, 20. So I got very, very strong. I became a 50 gunner, a 60 gunner. I could plop in a 55 gallon drum, M203s with the 40 mic shells, hit them right in the center of the drum, got very accurate with that. But every country that I had access to alcohol, I got in trouble, you know, and almost on borderline court-martial. Like in New Zealand, they got this stuff, well, not New Zealand, but in Korea when we went, they got this stuff called soju, which is it's Korean moonshine sold legally, and it's got about that much embalming fluid in the top of it. And what I heard about this stuff before I was ever there was that you can get drunk from one night and stay drunk for 3 days at least in a row. And I don't know about anybody else, but I was already there once I heard that. Like, that's it, you know. And so off we go. And sure enough, I didn't stay drunk for 3 days, but I stayed drunk for two. And, man, they have a problem. They give us directions. You have to report to post by 11 o'clock that night. Or if you come past that, you might as well stay out till 11 o'clock the next morning and then come, because you will get an Article 15. Now, at 2 o'clock in the morning, me and Corporal Black show up, and we're drunk as you know what on soju, and we don't look Korean, and they won't let us into the base. We're like, what? You know? And so, sure enough, I got Article 15 for that. The same thing happened in New Zealand. We got anybody here, when you're actively drinking, can pass over free alcohol? Good. No, I couldn't do it either, man. So, anyway, we're in New Zealand, and a sergeant major that was the equivalent to one of our warrant officers owned a Chinese restaurant, and he was taking us off the post that we were stationed at illegally every night. Not a big deal for us, because we're in the infantry. We can escape and evade, especially with nobody shooting at us. So that's what we did. And after after the fourth or fifth night, they lined all six of us up the next day, and the company commander was there, first sergeant. I'm not sure if my squad leader was there, not really important, but this is what they said. We haven't caught you yet. We know what you've been doing. But if you'll stop, we'll let bygones be bygones. Now, in another week, we had passes coming up where you could go fishing in the streams or go skiing up in the mountains in there. And New Zealand's like California. You could ski in the day and then go down to the beach at night, and it's like 70, 80 degrees. It's beautiful there, right? And so that's what I was doing. I was going to go skiing. But the next day, the guy's picking us up that night, you know, and it's like, I can't pass it up. And sure enough, they caught us 2 o'clock in the morning. We came stumbling in. And we, of course, we had our story. We were playing cards with Charlie Company. What we didn't do is check with Charlie Company to see where they were at. And they were out in the field. And needless to say, another Article 15. At the end of 3 years, my military career was about over. I was a Spec 4. They said that you can re-up, but we don't really want you here. They made that very clear, you know. And I got a high school diploma when I was in there. And I came back, and I had aspirations. I came back, and I applied to the Delaware State Police. Can you imagine me as a cop? Let me see your license. Got any drugs? You know, I would have ended up on, like, America's Most Wanted, you know, 95 corridor. That would have been mine, baby. Drugs and money, you know. I'm not doing nothing, you know. But the same guy that's a Vietnam vet, best friend of mine, Charlie, he asked me an alcoholic drug addict question to whether you're going to stay doing what you're doing. He goes, how are you going to arrest people for what you like to do? And instantly I did this thing called the alcoholic math. I did the weights and measures of it. And it meant for me to do that, I literally would have to stop doing what I was doing. And the pool by that time was so much, I was already a slave and didn't even know it. And sure enough, I still got the acceptance letter. I was supposed to be enrolled in the fall class of 1983, and so much for that. A year later, I was in the Air National Guard, finishing my last year of my six-year commitment, and I became self-employed again. I took a flight aptitude test, got accepted to go down to Fort Rucker, Alabama, to warrant officer school, because I was going to fly helicopters, qualified to do it, and within 3 months, I'm on my way to federal prison, because the feds, the state, and the county cops got notice, got wind of my self-employment, and they took offense to it, and off to federal prison I go. And so I'm in Lewisburg, and I'm looking up at the walls, and I'm scared to death, guys. Oh, shit, man. And like, they're like 60-foot walls, and there's bullet holes, machine gun holes in the wall, and I'm like, what the frick did I do? You know, I'm just a thief, you know? But anyway, I get it, and I ended up being transferred through there into a prison camp down in Petersburg, Virginia, through some political connections. My mom got me moved up into a co-ed prison camp, and I ended up there, and it's co-ed. There's no fence. There's women. I had a girlfriend. She had no teeth, but she was a girl. You know, that's better than being with him and him. If you're going to do time, do it with your opposite sex, baby. You know, you can walk to the liquor store, but I didn't, you know, and I'm sober. And I got a 32-hour furlough. You know, and I remember walking out of that place. They usually give you 36, but they gave me 32. And it's the only visit I ever got in federal prison. And here comes Charlie, and my mom's there. And all I know is I want to go to this diner and get bacon because they have that nasty turkey bacon. No offense to any vegans or whatever you call yourselves out there in the room. But I wanted some pork, you know, and I did. We went there and then right to the frickin' liquor store, because as I walked out of that prison, I knew I could give a clean breathalyzer. I knew it. I was right about that. What I didn't add into the equation, Charlie bought some of that non-approved AA stuff called marijuana. And while on the sixth or seventh beer, we debated on how much of that stuff I can inhale and give a clean urine. I knew, I knew 10 hits would be too much, but 4 sounded reasonable. You know, and no, it's not. They do full spectrum urinalysis, and 2 weeks later, I'm off to my end prison thing was up in Raybrook, New York. The Olympic Village is a federal prison up there, and my cellmate from that point on was a godfather of Rochester, New York, Charlie Ox and Davino. Don't know if I'm blowing his name or anything. Don't really care. You know, don't do nothing to me, Charlie. Anyway, so anyway, here I am. I'm hanging out with Italians. I'm not qualified to be there. I'm their gopher guy. They're getting coffee, and I'm trying to be like them, and I'm taking on their mannerisms. You know how the book says we're the consummate actor? And I'm like Megan. I'm trying to talk Italian and stuff. And by the way, I'm not Italian, you know, but it's not from a lack of trying and stuff. And I'm eating so much garlic. They're like, oh, my God, Megan, what am I? You know, and so anyway, that's what I do. And I end up getting out, and usually they give you 6 months in a halfway house. They love me. They gave me 30 days. I'm on my very first overnight furlough, and I was tired of being with him and him, and I wanted to be with her, not sure who her was. But I remember going out, my mom came and picked me up from the halfway house in Delaware, and I go to find her, and somebody handed me a beer that night, and I didn't make it home to the 10 o'clock curfew call. And that's a problem. I came to the next day in a holding cell at the halfway house. Apparently, they came and got me. And I had these nice white Italian loafers that weren't white anymore. There's vomit all over the place, and somebody's peed on me. And I know it's not my vomit because there's pink in that, and I didn't drink or eat anything pink that I remember. And so I could have risked going back fully to federal prison. What they did is restrict me for the next 3 weeks in the facility. I got a job at a graveyard, the only one I could find, right next door to the place. And I ended up in my second time in Alcoholics Anonymous because, as I stated earlier, it was this girl going in there, and I wanted what she had and was willing to go to England to get it. And that's where they were going. That's where I go. So I end up in the 12 and 12 cup up in Wilmington. I ended up going to parole, and then I had a special parole after that, which can be lifetime parole. And I ended up taking a hostage. I got a girl pregnant, who's now my wife. And eventually I would get sober March 18th of 1992. And I went there because I was in a drink and driving program. And by the way, I had a lot of drinking and driving programs. And for those of you that don't know, they become more progressively expensive the more you have to do. I didn't know that. And so I'm in my hopefully last drinking and driving program. And the guy is getting ready to fail me because I haven't done what they required. I signed a contract that I would go to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ain't going. You know, I'm an experiential educator at the time, working for Pecos River, which is a pretty prestigious job. Nobel Peace Prize scientist came through our course, and I helped teach him. I'm like a freaking chameleon. I can fit in anywhere. And I'm not qualified for that job, but I got that job through a friend of mine, and I stayed there for almost 3 years. And I learned how, it's like Outward Bound Ropes course type of stuff, and learning management employee training techniques and all this stuff. And I eventually would lose that job because they had open bar, and they left it unattended. And so, like, we're not done drinking, so what I'm going to do is I'm taking their booze back to my hotel room, and they got wind of it and didn't like that too much, don't really care, you know. It's okay as long as you don't get caught, right? And so anyway, I end up in this thing, and I'm failing. And the guy says that, look, I'll make you a deal. You got 2 weeks left of this. If you go to AA twice a week and show me that you've been going, I'll graduate you and you can get your license back. And that's what I did. And on that invitation alone, I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous for 2.5 years. You know, I was a meeting making money, you know what I'm saying? I made a lot of meetings, dude. Because that's what you hear, meeting makers make it. Shit, I'll just move in your freaking clubhouse. Why not, you know? And so that's what I do, you know, and I'm hanging out at your picnics and we're going to your carnivals and I joined an AA bowling league and an AA dart league, AA pool league. I'm AA, baby! The dog ate the first 80 pages of the book. So it's like, I don't know. I did my own version of the steps. I was told you can do your program. Watch doing them steps. You know, fourth will get you a fifth. You know, and this, people make up so much shit. Let's just get rid of all that garbage and nonsense and stick to what's outlined in the book. Tell people the truth so they at least have a fighting chance. I don't have a clue because nobody in my area is telling me the truth. And even if they're there, I'm not listening to them. Because I have alcoholic hearing. I only hear what I want. You know? And I drink again in 1995. And by the end of that, I put a group of guys together to rob banks on Federal Reserve drop day. True story. You know? And I had a dream where we were in a shootout for cops. And it didn't end up well for me. So I go running in the A the very next day. Sober up! You know? And then the problem was is I had 3 recovered alcoholic sponsors. And each one of them would get me up to that thing called the 9th step. And as an ex-con, I don't want to do that. One, I don't want you to have my money. Valid reason, right? And two, my philosophy is that all 3 of them would get me up to step 9. And I'm like, you're asking me, and I'm still interpreting my own version, even though that's not what they're saying. But you're asking me to tell on myself. Mind you, buddy, I'll snitch on you in a heartbeat, but I ain't snitching on me. Screw you. You know, I know how that goes, you know. He's like, no, you know. But what I would tell my sponsors, all of them, was like, man, I just made an amends yesterday. You want their number? Yeah. The yeah, I know, and the yeah, buts was part of my, you know. And I remember my now sponsor and grand sponsor coming up to me at the Sunlight Experience Conference in 1999. My ex-brother-in-law had just OD'd and died the night before from a heroin overdose in front of my 2 nephews that were like 3 and 4 at the time, or 5. You know, and I remember getting home that next day and them crying at Aunt Stacy. You know, Stacy, my wife, was telling me that they were saying, Zach and Josh were saying, Aunt Stacy, he's something's wrong with it. You know, he's got a needle sticking out of his arm. He's turning blue and stuff. And I came home to that. And the day or the day after, Keith and Chris came up to help me, and they tried to help me, and I'm sober longer than them. And my ego is so like this, you can't get through it. God would have taken a jackhammer and dynamite and nitroglycerin and went and got through it. And I would have to drink again. And I remember walking away from that conversation knowing that those guys are sober less time than me, but they're content and happy. And asking myself, why ain't I got that? You know, and because I like sounding good. I used to go to this meeting off the Beltway where the average length of time, and there's close to this many people in that room, but the average length of time in the room at that time was 30 to 40 years. And I would hear what these old timers would say, and I'd go running back up to Westminster House. Lamar, anybody remember Lamar? One of the most beloved people. He died with like 55 years of sobriety a few years ago. He was my grand sponsor at the time. We used to, and that was his meeting, one of the meetings. He was at the 857 Club, but that was Nunn and him and these other people would all go to this meeting off the Beltway on Saturdays at 11 o'clock. And I used to eat lunch with him every day on that Saturday. But anyway, I digress. I would go get what these guys say and then go back to Westminster House and regurgitate it my way. And what people would say to me after a meeting, man, you sound good. And I'd be like, yeah. I should. It's not my fucking experience, you know? But I didn't know, because it was about sounding good. It's about looking good. It's not about bearing any truth. You know, you got to look good, you know? And I don't have a clue. And again, I would drink again. 2000, man, I would drink again. And it stayed out there until I came back to AA one more time. And I did the alcoholic math at a beginner's meeting on my fourth or fifth day in AA in June of 2001, which is not my sobriety date. And I did the alcoholic math. I was like, Dave, you were here the first time, 2.5 years. Here the second time, 4.5 years. You'll be here the rest of your life, get at least 10 years. But within 2 days, I'm in a bar in Chestertown, Maryland, dead broke, no money. And my coworkers, when we go into the bar, and I'm going to go to AA that night. But when we walked in that bar, because it had gotten so bad with the secondary infections called crack cocaine. Whoops, should say that. But anyway, that takes all the money in one night. Don't matter how much you get that Bill Gates money, it's going to abuse it all. But anyway, so I'm like, I had, you know, I took my cigarettes. I didn't even have cigarettes that week. You know how bad it is when you ain't even got cigarettes to smoke and you kind of need to smoke? Don't have gas. So I'm riding with the boss's son to work. That Friday, we get our paychecks, no cash, no ability to cash them. And they told me, because they knew I was trying to get sober, they said, Dave, when we go in here to this bar, we're going in for 2 drinks and then leaving. We'll buy you a Pepsi. Right? Sounds like a good plan, right? They forgot to tell the bartender. Because I'm telling you, man, and that, I'm telling you, I coached Little League the day before. Now, here I am, my oldest son, I'm his Little League, one of the coaches on the team. Kind of hard to do when you smoke rock cocaine till 5 o'clock in the morning. Coach little kids like, Johnny, pick up the goddamn ball! You know, I'm like, and they're like, parents are getting their kids, oh my God, Mr. Phillips is coaching again. They're literally walking their kids off the field. You know, so it's bad. So they told me to only order a Pepsi, but when I stood in front of the bartender, I got CRS. Anybody here ever have CRS? Can't remember shit. And I, F it, give me a Budweiser. And I took those guys hostage that night. True story. Made him buy me whiskey, made him buy me tequila. I'm not a big guy. Took martial arts, almost became a black belt in two different forms. It's very dangerous. Can get me killed, but can also hurt people. But I did take those guys hostage that night. And off to the races again. And my sobriety date this time is July 22nd of 2001. My home group's a big book study group up in Newport, Delaware. Chris Brennan and Ricky D'Angelo out of the Keystone group come up every Tuesday when they can. Most of the time, it takes us a very long time. We started in September. We are just now up to working with others. And when they're not there doing it, I fill in for them and stuff. So I'm very intimate. I was told in the beginning, read 2 pages out of this book, big book every day. I've done that for almost 13 years now. Every day. Did it this morning. Read another AA literature. Read non-AA spiritual literature, right? Because that's very important along with prayer and meditation. So anyway, I come in and I'm dying from untreated alcoholism. And like, I would not wish the next 30 days on my worst enemies, because it literally... I melted over the next 30 days. Just not drinking did not solve my alcoholism, guys. Just going to meetings, 2 and 3 meetings a day, which I was doing, did not solve my alcoholism. Sharing about my problems did not freaking solve my alcoholism. Matter of fact, it made it worse. A problem shared is a problem have. Go F yourself. That just makes it worse. Shut up. You know, because I can do that. And they're telling me these things. They're telling me to read the first 3 steps out of 12 and 12. There's no directions for the steps in the 12 and 12. But I did it because that's what they said to do. They said, write gratitude lists. I wrote gratitude lists till my hands are bleeding. It didn't help. And then share at every meeting, but only talk about the good stuff. But when you want to kill yourself daily and kill others because you're suicidal and homicidal, can't just be one. Man, it's bad. So you can't really share about any good stuff. So it's bad. On day 13, I had a nervous breakdown. I'm fighting with the wife, and she tells me this. Now tell me this is bad, but she says, why don't you drink and take a fucking in while you're at it? You know, a-hole. And on the way to that meeting that night, I tried to commit suicide, so I picked out the biggest telephone pole on the way, and I stepped on the gas, and I'm cussing God at the same time, asking him, what the F do you want from me? And I look down at the last second, and there's that anti-suicide device called the airbag. And my wife's disabled. She got into a bad accident, cages in her back. And like, I veered away. And, of course, I went to the men's meeting that night, and I'm crying. And this old, you know them crusty old-timers? They're real mean, and they laugh at all the inappropriate times. We had one there that night. And he stopped me in the middle of my crying jag. He gives me the whoa-whoas. He goes, kid, I'm going to say something. Shut up. I'm going to say something. And it probably hurt your feelings, but I don't care. I'd rather step on your toes than step on your grave. Every time I've been watching you. Every time you've been in AA, you've done BB and CC. You've never done AA. And I didn't have an answer for that. 2 weeks later, I'm in a meeting in downtown Baltimore, Harbor City Speaker Group, and I was given a sponsor that night. I went up and asked this old gray-haired guy who I knew before. He was my grand sponsor at one time. And I asked him for help, and he gave me a sponsor. I didn't know that guy from Adam. But I was so scared to go around these people, I took my non-alcoholic wife with me, you know, my safety blanket. And it was so powerful. Doreen was celebrating her third anniversary, and I was at her first, man. And like it was, she was an angel. And I didn't identify with her drunk a lot. You know, she talked about one of her last drunks falling down and bruising her face. Hell, who hasn't done that? You know, that's a Tuesday night. Come on. You know? Monday night. Shit, Monday morning. Who knows? You know, but anyway, I digress. She talked about something that caught my attention in here. And she said when she looked in the mirror to clean up her face, the eyes that stared back were black as coal. And I had that experience getting high in the bathroom. And I was born with hazel eyes, but the eyes that stared back that day, that night, were unrecognizable. It just coal can't even describe the color that stared back at me. And that caught my attention. Then she talked about being given a sponsor and going right through the steps. And she recovered. And she had this thing called happy sobriety. And if you want what we have, you got to do what we do. Something to that effect. And man, my life changed. And so that night, Tom gave me a sponsor. I didn't pick my sponsor. Can you imagine me picking somebody I could identify with? Let me get some other homicidal, suicidal lunatic. That's a match made in you know what, you know? And so he asked me, he goes, you have a big book. And I didn't want to admit what happened to my big book. And my wife, who's not alcoholic, goes like this, elbows me, and she goes, he can use mine. And I looked at her like she's growing another head on her neck, like, what the frick are you doing with the big book? Apparently, she wanted to know why we do what we do. This book will tell them, you know? And so he asked me, have you ever read the doctor's opinion? And I'm laughing. Yeah, of course I had. Dr. Bob's story, right? I didn't know. Who reads a frickin'? I've been to college. I've never read the Roman numeral section of any book. Give me a frickin' break. And By the way, the doctor's opinion used to be chapter 1. Kind of probably should have left it there, in my opinion. As you can tell, I got a little bit of opinions. I'm allowed to have that, I think. A little bit. Not too much. I don't know. Anyway, so he asked me to read it 3 times and meet him the next day because I didn't have a full social calendar. Guess what? I said, okay. You ever get to the point in your walk trying to get sober where you just, I'll do anything rather than do that? And it's not your words that are being watched by God. It's your actions that follow those words. Because the decision is useless unless you're following it with action. And so I showed up 40 miles from my house. That's kind of willing to go to any lengths, ain't it? You want what we have? Hell, I would have crawled through glass and shot puddle water to get what I wanted to get high. What won't I do to get this? And so George, through the very, like 40 minutes in a meeting, he began identifying whether I'm alcoholic or not. You know, as sponsors, we're supposed to do that with our sponsees. It says it right in working with others. If you're satisfied the person you're working with is alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless malady that we have. So I have to be satisfied that the people I'm working with, what's their truth? Are they a real alcoholic? Maybe they're a real drug addict. I don't know. But we can find that out through the book. But by the way, if you're powerless, you're screwed. Because all human power fails us, right? And so George began qualifying me. And by the end of that, before we got to the meeting, he begins taking me through we did the 1, 2, and 3 because there's no work. Guess what? Here's some anti-rehab talk. There's no work in step 1, okay? Either you're alcoholic or you're not. Powerless or you're not. There's no work in step 2. There's not. Bill Wilson even wrote that in 12 and 12. Those 2 steps are consideration. And there ain't no work in step 3. You ever hear somebody, I'm working on step 3? What the hell are you talking about? There's no work in step 3. It's a decision to fire you and hire God. It's actually a spiritual covenant between you and your Creator. And by the way, you're never without God because God's inside of you. You were born with it. It's part of our birthright. But I didn't know any of that stuff because I don't know. Somebody had to point that stuff out to me. But I was humbled enough to pray with the guy. He held my hand. I didn't think it was gay. Nothing wrong about that, you know. But I didn't care. I'll do anything. And so he begins giving me the directions for my 4-step. And that night I left with hope. I'm telling you, I had hope unlike I had ever experienced before. It was like being for the very first Christmas when you're cognitive enough to be aware that it's something beautiful has happened. It's like you've got the best gift in the world and nobody will ever be able to take it from you. You know, this is like a trade. I'm a plasterer by trade. I learned, I apprenticed, and I went into the union and I did that. Nobody will ever be able to take that skill from me. Guess what else people can't take from me? My recovery and my walk with God. Nothing is that powerful that can ever remove that relationship other than me looking at myself in the mirror, becoming my own higher power again, which I don't have any desire to do. So George missed some of the directions out of the four step, like there's a bunch of prayers in the four step, but he gave me the best of what he had, right? And I'm not here to fault George. George right now, there's some stuff that you don't really want to do, like sleeping with your sponsor's girlfriend or wife is not a good thing, you know, and it could end up you drunk. And my sponsor, that was his experience, you know, and my grand sponsor then became my sponsor, and eventually we would have to go back through the steps again, and because I had missed a bunch of stuff, and at 2 years experience, my wife decided to leave, and she slept with one of my sponsees. I caught him in bed together. I was doing a lot of skydiving at the time. I became sort of addicted to skydiving. Not a good hobby if you're a crackhead methamphetamine junkie. You might do it alcoholically. And I was jumping 15 to close to 20 times a day, twice a week. I owned a construction company and got my own equipment, base jumping and stuff. And, you know, my sponsee misunderstood the term wanting what we have and willing to go to any length to get it. That's not what they were talking about, you know. And, you know, it was a shock. And I spoke at my second year anniversary at Harbor City, the first time I ever spoke there in front of 200 people dying because that had happened the week before. And my then sponsor, which is Dave Doss, he's spoken here before, he got up there and he said, for all my sponsees out there, stay away from my wife. You know, and everybody laughed, but here I am, I'm dying, you know. And eventually, at 6 months from that time, I had to humble myself and go back through the steps and clean up my side of the street because I caused a lot of that. And I remember going through the steps with my now sponsor, with this, Keith Wilt, who's spoken here too. He spoke at your Acts of Recovery. And we're going through and we're dotting the I's and crossing our T's, man. And we're doing the prayers. And when we did the fifth step, and I'm looking at my part, he asked me, he said, Dave, how could you, you know, you were having sex with your wife when she was asleep. You were making her feel like garbage, like your piece of property. How could you judge her for what she did and how she chose to leave? And I was the very first one that cheated in that relationship back in the 90s with a woman from AA. So who am I to judge how she chose to leave? You know, none of my business. Well, anyway, I went to make amends to my soon-to-be ex-wife at the time. And the kids, and I sat them down, and I said, what can I do to make it right? Now, mind you, during that 6 months, I was stalking her and the kids, you know, while sponsoring guys. And I don't recommend that. This new guy I had with me goes, Dave, I know I'm only 2 weeks sober, but you got a court order against you, and you're breaking a law right now. As we sat outside my wife's house, and he was in there with her and stuff. And I was like, shut up, what do you know? You're only 2 weeks sober. You know, I'm over 2 years sober. And that guy had better sobriety than me. I was untreated, very untreated. And I think he's still here to this day. But anyway, when I went there and made amends to him, man, I was, you know, it's not that I was filled with guilt, remorse, and shame. I just wanted to do whatever it was to make it right between them. And I asked them what I can do to make it right. And they asked me not to come around anymore. And I was like, you got it, whatever you want. And I began paying support from that point on. And for the first time in my life, I was free, like I've never been before. Like from that point on, I was no longer dependent on another one of God's kids for my happiness. It was going to be totally dependent on my relationship with God. When we got up to step 11 with my sponsor, and I'd been doing my page 86 review every night, but what I was failing to do is I was failing to do the 10th step during the day. And by the way, in my experience, if I don't do 10-step and when needed, and watch for those four things and take the four corrective measures, my 11-step really is like null and void. Even it's important, but it may keep me in there, but it may make me nuts. So we began doing it and doing exactly what's outlined and stuff, and we did the prayers in the 4-step and everything, 6 and 7, 8, 9. And so I'm doing this stuff, and And I got up till 11, and my sponsor goes, "So how is your meditation life?" And I didn't have a clue what he's freaking talking about. He goes, I was like, "What is that? What are you talking about?" He goes, "Your quiet time with God after your prayers and after your reading's done." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, I used to do it in the beginning. I would just sit outside. There's guided meditation. Dave, there's so much on meditation with babies at this. But I would highly suggest you do it every day and at night when you're doing your nightly review. You know, when you ask God's forgiveness and what corrective measures." And so I began doing that, and man, it was anywhere from 10 minutes up to half hour or more every day, you know, and along with reading the stuff. And eventually the wife and the kids wanted me back in her life, you know, and because Bruce couldn't stay sober, and he's dying from what we got. And, you know, eventually they asked me fully back in her life. And I've had a relationship with my wife that nowadays that is just, it's unbelievable. It's phenomenal. It's an actual relationship. She's not a hostage. We're partners today. And so I told you about the skydiving thing. And when Dave makes the national news, it's never for good stuff. Back in the 80s, I made half the news journal paper out of Wilmington for being self-employed. August 1st of 2005, I was doing base jumping, and not that day, but base jumping. I learned it that year, and I was doing wingsuits out of helicopters because we're getting ready to go over Europe and do wingsuits off the Alps and stuff and in Norway. And I wanted to take my mom on vacation because as a child, she came from a wealthy family and toured Europe, and now she's dirt poor, and I wanted to take her, you know, and do that stuff with her while doing base jumping. And I'm also, because normal skydiving is boring, I'm doing this stuff called high performance. I can land on a quarter from 15,000 feet. One of the best canopy pilots in the world taught me how to do that, put a class on for me and some others that asked him to come up, and he did, and I excelled at it. But even that became boring, so I'm doing this high performance landing. And I got told 2 weeks prior to that jump day, August 1st, is that, "Dave, you're being dangerous, man. You're hooking it in way too low." And by that time, I had the bug, man. I had hooked it and got it right, but I dragged my knees. But, man, I was like, "I'm on fire. I'm going to do this." And my response to my base instructor slash free fly instructor slash swoop instructor was like, "Donnie, I got this." Not good for an alcoholic to say that. And the next thing I know is I hit the ground doing over 40 miles an hour in a swoop. Shattered my pelvis, my sacrum, both my feet, and nicked my femoral artery and lay dying on the ground. Came to out of a drug-induced coma 13 and a half days later, paralyzed from the waist down, scared to death. And not because I'm paralyzed, because I look up and they got me on fentanyl. Dude, I'm like, "Oh my God, I've been a junkie since I was 14, 15. How am I going to get through that?" And I remember crying to my sponsor, "How am I going to get through that?" He said, "Dave, you followed the directions in the book. You didn't follow your directions in skydiving, which is why you're in bed. You got to follow directions, brother. And but let them know you're an alcoholic," and that's what I did. And I had a kind doctor that was able to get me off the fentanyl and put me on oral morphine, and I was able to fully come off everything in 3 months while still in horrendous pain. And I remember one of those times one of the first times I could take a bath. I mean, if you've ever gone from like not being able to bathe to bathing, oh my God, it's like heaven. But nobody was there in the house, and I tried to get out of the tub, and I can't move, and I'm in a horrendous pain. Even the fentanyl and morphine couldn't handle the amount of pain I'm in. And I fell out of the bathtub, and I'm in so much pain, I just looked up and said, "God, why didn't you let me come home?" You know what God told me? "I'm not done with you yet, son." I never asked that question again. You know, he got my attention. So what they did for me is that they not only brought AA meetings to me, this might be kind of tough love, they brought me people to take through the steps. And I remember saying to them, "What the frick do you want me to do with them? I can't even wipe my own butt." And they said, "Dave, quit thinking about you. That got you in the bed in the first place. Think how you can help them." And again, I would say, just like it did at year one this time, when asked to do something that's going to help me, that is God's will, is okay. That guy didn't stay sober, but I did. And I'll leave you with this. There's more miracles that I would have to spend too much time to discuss, but I want to leave this one thing with you. There was this guy, Mike. Now, I had just came off the meds, and I'm in horrendous pain, and I'm learning how to walk again. The physical therapist, the only thing different between physical therapists No offense to any of them in the audience, if there is any. And the marquee to Sod is they have newer freaking magazines. They're freaking torturers, man. And they're moving my feet and stuff like this. You know, but I'm walking with a walker. I just came out of a wheelchair. And I'm learning how to walk again. And I've got to take this kid, Mike, through the steps. And so I'm in a Main Street step meeting that Paula and her girls were doing. And I'm dreading it. And I'm in so much pain. I'm rocking side to side with my hands underneath me, man, and I'm just almost in tears. I'm in that much pain, and I don't want to do what I agreed to do, which is take this kid, Mike, through the steps, because I don't know where we're going to open the book at, and I don't know how long we're going to be in the book, and I don't know when we're going to be done, but all I want to do is go home and go to sleep, because the only time at that time I would get any relief from the pain is being asleep, because I didn't like being medicated, because I don't like being fogged. I like being awake and aware of the presence of God within me and being awake and aware of you guys, and so we did it. We get into my truck, and I'm walking out there with the truck, and I throw the walker up in the back, and I had to lift my legs up at the time. That's how disabled still I was at the time. And I lift the legs up, and we did the exact same prayer you guys did here, set-aside prayer. Thank God for Mark Houston and those guys, wherever they got that from. I love them, because I do it with my guys when I'm and gals that I've taken through the steps. And so we do this set-aside prayer, and we brought God into it. And guess what? My pain freaking left. Gone for like an hour and a half, 2 hours. Gone. It's like I'm not injured. I could get up and dance. I didn't, but it felt like I could. That'll get your attention, because it got my attention. Don't know where we ended up in the steps that night. Not really important, because Mike is still here to this day, because the two things were present that day. Actually, three things were present. I had somebody who was willing to go to any lengths. I was willing to go to any lengths, and we both invited our Heavenly Father into this. And let God's grace bless both of us. Just got goosebumps from it. But anyway, my pain's gone. And then I'm not sure where we ended up. We do a closing prayer to bring us back to the present moment. Mike goes his way. I go my way. I turn down and go on Main Street, Newark, Delaware, and about maybe 500 feet down the road, it felt like somebody hit me with a baseball bat in my back, and my pain came fully back. I've asked for years, guys, who on earth, where did that pain come from? Where did the pain go? See, in a lot of my journeys in trying to seek some type of oneness with my Maker, I read the Bible and I read the Quran, I read the Book of Mormon, I read Buddhism books, and I read guru books and all these different type of books. And all of them had this underlying thing in there that there's utterances of the Spirit that the mind will never be able to understand. And the reason it is because mind, where the ego centers, which is our main dilemma, because we have an ego malady. Because I don't think our spirit is maladjusted. It's not. It's been awake, aware of God since we were born. But it's my ego that separates me from you and me from my Creator. But there's another line in there that says, if it is in His way, He will move it. And He did. I have no other explanation for that. God has been showing up in my life for longer than I can remember. And I've been cognitive of it, but unwilling to do anything about it. And like my friend Dave, who was my sponsor, and he's still a dear friend of mine, Dave Dawson, Baltimore, says, he said, Dave, God will do 99% of this for us on this journey. We only have to do 1%, but He expects us to do 100% of our 1%. So ask yourself this, how's your prayer life? How's your meditation life? And how are you consistently helping God's other kids to get well? Because if you're not about that, then are you really about your Father's business? Or is it possible, because you don't meditate, which means listen to God enough, you've made your mind God, and you're asleep thinking you're awake? Guys, we all need to wake up. Because that's what this book says. That's what our founders passed on to us. And we all have a responsibility to carry this message to the best of human ability. And I hope I did that tonight. Thank you very much.